This is the BBC.
Chinese characters. Historian Rana Mitter tells the story of China in 20 remarkable lives. Part 2. The Asian Power Couple.
November 1943. The Germans are in retreat from the Soviet Union. A turning point in the Second World War. All eyes now turn south.
This new great council of war had assembled in North Africa to lay down far-reaching plans for the future prosecution of the war in general and operations against Japan in particular. Britain, America, and China expressed their resolve to exert unrelenting pressure on Japan, compelling her to disgorge the territory she has seized and occupied even before the First World War in 1914. A busy time for the newsreel cameramen and photographers. Flashlight globes littered the lawns as a small army of men recorded the scene for posterity.
It's quite a photograph, the one those abandoned flashlight globes captured.
To Mr. Churchill, the nation is again indebted for...
Churchill looking rather splendid in his white safari suit.
Mr. Roosevelt was making his seventh wartime meeting with the Prime Minister.
The smiling figure of FDR is there too. And prominent also, that Chinese man, in uniform. His smile, a little hesitant, as if he's not quite sure he ought to be there in the first place.
Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek had previously not met the Premier or President in person.
Chiang Kai-shek, President of China, Generalissimo, and head of the Nationalist Party, or Kuomintang. And the place is Cairo, November 1943. This is one of the major conferences of the Second World War. And for the first time in history, a non-Western leader is sitting next to the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the British Empire as an equal partner. As symbols go, this is a major, major moment. Chiang's journey to that seat in Cairo was a long one. And yet, for some three decades or so, he was one of the most important figures not just in China, but in world politics, from the aftermath of the Great War to the height of the Cold War. Chiang grew up at a time of turmoil. He was born near Ningbo in Zhejiang Province in east-central China in 1887. This was an era very different from the Tang Dynasty, when our previous Chinese character, Emperor Wu Zetian, was on the throne in a period of relative peace and prosperity. By the late 19th century, a millennium later, China was in one of the greatest crises in its history. Western gunboats had forcibly opened up its ports during the Opium Wars that had begun in the 1830s. And the empire's Qing dynasty found itself increasingly helpless against the combined forces of Western arms, ideology, and opium. In 1911, the tensions inside and outside the country led to the overthrow of its last emperor. And the young Chiang Kai-shek soon gained a taste for adventure and joined the Republican Revolution, toting a rifle in support of the new Chinese state, Asia's first republic. But things soon fell apart. China was divided by rival warlord armies and increasing incursions from foreign powers. So in the 1920s, Chiang, along with many other young men and women, joined a new force, the Chinese Nationalist Party, led by the great revolutionary leader Sun Yat-sen. In 1925, Sun Yat-sen died of cancer. Chiang Kai-shek fought his way to the top spot and led a campaign that meant the uneasy and partial reunification of China and the defeat of the warlords in 1927. But it was a victory created with immense violence. Here in Shanghai, hundreds of young men and women were brutally attacked and killed by local gangsters. Chiang Kai-shek had taken control of Shanghai, then, as now, China's greatest port city and cosmopolitan gateway to the wider world. But as he did so, he turned on his communist allies. He'd grown increasingly suspicious that their real masters might not be in Shanghai, but Moscow, and that they were likely to launch a coup against his leadership. He struck first. The price was high, but Chiang got what he wanted. A Chinese government under his control. At least for now. And on the 1st of December that same year, 1927, another figure became central to his life. On that date, Chiang married a woman as far from his own experience as could be imagined. He came from a rural background and was deeply Chinese in his cultural horizons. She was from a rich Chinese family with long overseas trading connections. And she had learnt fluent English when she took her degree from Wellesley College in Massachusetts. She was sometimes teased that her English was better than her Chinese. Her name was Sung Mei Ling. She would become better known to the world as Madame Chiang Kai-shek. Together, they made one of Asia's first power couples. And there was little doubt that her political thoughts and choices were almost as important as Chiang's. With her fluent English, she was his window to the world. And that window would need to be kept open when China faced its greatest challenge of the 20th century. The growing force of Chinese nationalism was coming into confrontation with the force of Japanese imperialism, the desire to expand on Asia's mainland. In summer 1937, Japanese troops stationed in North China came to blows with local Chinese soldiers. Within days, the two countries were in a state of all-out war.
Now that Shanghai is occupied, the spearhead of Japan's attack is pushing west. Suzhou has fallen, on the road to China's capital, Nanking. But between Japan's army and Nanking is China's Hindenburg Line, manned by Chiang Kai-shek's best trained and equipped divisions. But already the Chinese government has moved west to Nanking.
Here in the centre of Shanghai, very close to where I'm standing on Nanjing Road, a Chinese nationalist Air Force bomber was supposed to unleash its load on a Japanese warship in the harbour. Instead, things went terribly wrong. It dropped the bombs on the busiest shopping street in the city. Just outside the Cathay Hotel, a few steps from here, nearly 1,000 people died.
The bombing of the Cathay Hotel shocked the world, and these pictures have been rushed to the screen by ship and plane to portray with all the vivid truth of an eyewitness the senseless horror of war.
It wasn't just in Shanghai that the Japanese invasion led to death and destruction. Chiang's government moved 800 miles inland to the southwestern city of Chongqing, where for 4.5 years it fought almost alone against the Japanese invasion. Chiang held on, rather like Churchill, all the way to Pearl Harbor. And both leaders heard the news of the Japanese attack on the US with the conviction that their countries would now be saved. From December 1941, Chiang was no longer a Chinese leader fighting on his own. He was now part of an alliance with two of the most powerful nations on Earth. The Allies called that conference in Cairo in late 1943 to discuss the future of Asia after Japan's defeat. In the end, it didn't settle all that much, but the symbolism was immense. At a time when most of Asia and Africa was either occupied or colonized, China was able to sit as an equal, at least in name, with the two Western giants. Madame Chiang was central too. She sat in the photo next to Churchill. And earlier that year, she'd become the first Chinese and only the second woman to address both houses of Congress in Washington, D.C.
You, as representatives of the American people, have before you the glorious opportunity of carrying on the pioneer work of your ancestors beyond the frontiers of physical and geographical limitations. You have today.
It's worth reflecting how unusual Madame Chiang was at the time, not just as a Chinese, but in terms of global politics. There was only one woman in the US cabinet at that time, and none in the British. Very few women who were political, with the possible exception of Eleanor Roosevelt, were known outside their own countries. Yet Sung Mei Ling operated, if not as a joint ruler, at least as the most powerful interpreter of China's case to the outside world.
I can also assure you that China is eager and ready to cooperate with you and other peoples to lay a true and lasting foundation for a sane and progressive world society which would make it impossible for any arrogant or predatory neighbor to plunge future generations into another orgy of blood.
Now, after his wife had wowed Washington, it was the husband's turn to shine. "My first appearance on the world stage," noted Zhang in his diary, as he flew back from Cairo with Madame Zhang. It had been, perhaps always would be, his finest hour. Things went downhill from there. Zhang's government was weak and riddled by corruption and black marketeering. It had used up much of its strength and resources in fighting alone for the first 4 years of the war, and it was on the verge of collapse by the time the atomic bombings ended the war in 1945. Then Chiang and his old enemies, the communists under Mao Zedong, ended their truce and broke into civil war in 1946. 3 years later, it was over. The weakened and unpopular nationalists were driven into exile on the island of Taiwan. Mao Zedong declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China. When Zhang died in 1975, he'd been away from the mainland for over a quarter century. Madame hung on much longer, but by her death in New York in 2003, aged 105, few remembered a faded lady who had once been considered a new empress of China. Yet if you go to Zhang's birthplace in Zhejiang province today, you'll see signs and records that he's been at least partially rehabilitated as a patriot who did fight Japan. And his legacy is more tangible, if less obvious, in the wider world. Go to the United Nations in New York. China is one of just 5 countries that holds a permanent seat on the Security Council. That seat was awarded to China in 1946 because of its record as a wartime ally. It wasn't awarded to the communist leader, Mao Zedong, although he would eventually take hold of it in 1971. And in today's China, there are plenty of signs that Zhang and Sung are being taken seriously once again. But to find that out, you might have to make your way past some rather assertive tour guides. There's a whole bunch of images here of Chiang Kai-shek during the war years at the presidential palace in the centre of Nanjing, pictures of his National Assembly, big colour portrait, and a diorama of him and his wife, Song Meiling, relaxing on a sofa. People here do look very, very interested, maybe not reverent in the way they do towards Mao, but certainly very positive, and I think that is a sign that Chiang Kai-shek's role as the man who led resistance against Japan on behalf of the national government is recognised and acknowledged in China today. Our first two Chinese characters, Emperor Wu Zetian and the Changsong marriage, have been portraits of how power has operated in China. Our next set of characters show us how China's cultures have always crossed boundaries. We're starting with a man whose words are chanted daily by millions of Chinese, but whose name is hardly known.